Last month, the body of an 85-year-old grandma was found stabbed and partially burnt at her flat here in Paris. Officials say Mireille Knoll was murdered because she was Jewish.
In several U.S. cities, investigations are underway into possible hate crimes against Muslims.
A wave of violence against elderly Asian Americans putting communities across the country on edge.
Hate crimes. They're ugly, frightening. They reveal the darkest impulses of humanity. What drives them, and why are they on the rise? This is Global Affairs Today. Let's start the conversation. Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Imani Cherry. We all know what the word hate means, and we know what the word crime means, but what are we really talking about when we put those two words together? Today, we're talking about hate crimes. What are they? What impact do they have? And are they on the rise around the world? To start our conversation today, I am so glad to be able to talk with Pastor O'Shane Winter. Welcome, Pastor Winter.
Hey, thank you for having me today.
So you're the pastor of a church in Aurora, Colorado. Is that right?
That is correct. I pastor two churches, the New Community and the Boston Street Church.
Oh, wow. So tell us a little bit about your ministry in Aurora.
Well, I just moved here of last year, beginning of 2020 at the start of the pandemic. So that was an interesting pastoral start. I preside over two predominant African-American churches, or one of them more so Afro-Caribbean. And so our area that we minister to is more in the lower income.
So tell us what happened this year. On January 9, something happened to you.
Yeah, well, I was at the church and just finished up one of our yearly meetings, nominating committee. Was coming home from church. And when I pulled up to my garage, I noticed that there were racial slurs written all over my garage. Now, this was shortly after the incident on the Capitol, which took place on January the 6th. And so when I came home and I saw the writing on the garage, I was really taken back by it. I couldn't believe that someone would use the N-word on my garage. And so we definitely felt violated. I remember calling the police immediately, going upstairs to check on my family and my children, just to make sure everyone was safe. And, you know, we reported it. And one of the things that the officers mentioned to us is that they have seen these kinds of hate crimes taking place more and more in the Denver, Aurora area, especially during the last 4 years of our former president's time in office.
Wow, that must have been extremely traumatic. How has that impacted your family?
Well, it was quite frightening, especially when we saw the words written on the garage. And what was more frightening about it as well was the fact that I was the only African American on that street that had a garage. And so no one else's garage had racial slurs on it except for mine. And so, you know, we felt targeted. So after that incident, we decided to move. We moved out actually immediately with the help of some of my elders and some of the pastors from the Rocky Mountain Conference, you know, that came over and helped. And so we just felt unsafe. I was, you know, constantly on edge. Every time I left the home, I was feeling nervous, just feeling like someone was watching, or, you know, I'm a victim of some type of, you know, hate crime. And so we weren't comfortable. We decided to move immediately after that incident.
Wow. So you mentioned that some of the pastors and officials from the Rocky Mountain Conference helped you. What kind of outpour of support that you've received after that? What does that look like for you and your family?
Yeah, so I'm in the regional conference. For those who do not know, that is the Black conference here in North America. As I mentioned, not only did I get support from my own colleagues in the regional, but it was a wonderful thing because we also had people, the pastors from the state conference, come over, right? And they helped me move. They were just so hands-on with helping this process to be easy for our family. And so we received so much love from our conference, from the state conference, from their members. Someone got us a new security system. So we just had an overwhelming support as well. And we were just so thankful that in a time of crisis, our brothers and sisters, showed up and came to help.
That's so important. So I want to ask you, what is the message that you want to relay about hate crimes?
You know, I think hate crimes is a result of the heart not being converted, you know, people not having a relationship with Jesus. And as a result of that, you know, Jesus says, you know, out of the heart, you know, spring forth murder, hate, lust, and various things. And so for those who may be, you know, struggling with hate crimes or harboring hate crimes, you know, I would highly encourage them to, you know, seek a saving relationship with Jesus, because he is able to take away any pain, any struggles that we're dealing with. And I think that's the root cause. You know, I think we all have issues that we struggle with, dislikes, things that we like. But Jesus is the ultimate healer. And I believe he's the one that can bring the peace that the soul needs. And so that would be my encouragement to anyone who is struggling with, you know, some form of hatred, is to really bring it to Jesus, and he will help you to get through it.
Shane, thank you so much for sharing your story and your message. We really appreciate you being with us.
Certainly. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, our conversation about hate crime continues. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking today about a difficult subject, hate crimes. I'm glad to welcome our guest today to help us understand this topic a bit better. Richard Fulton is a religious freedom attorney, a scholar, and former director of national and legislative affairs at the American Jewish Committee. And Dr. Waris Hussein is a professor at Howard University School of Law and a former policy analyst at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So at the top of the show, we just heard O'Shane's story. I just want to ask each of you, did his story resonate with you in any way? Richard, I'll start with you.
Sure, absolutely did. I mean, we have a sharp rise in this country of hate crimes incidents, some involving physical violence, but certainly both in the Jewish community and elsewhere, we're seeing the rise in incidents of the kind he described, where swastikas or Free Palestine writings are written on synagogues, on people's homes. So yes, it resonated quite a bit, and is a sad reflection on the state of affairs at this moment.
Waris, what about you?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's quite a disturbing story that this should be happening in the United States in 2020. You know, and a lot of the same kinds of, or some of the similar kinds of incidents that the pastor described are happening with the Muslim American community as well, with higher rates. And so we're seeing a lot of victimization of different groups happening, and the rise is kind of for everyone in some ways. And it's rather disturbing, and we would have to take and must take action to address these kinds of issues.
So, Richard, I'm going to start with you. We just want to lay the framework here for our viewers. So what exactly is a hate crime?
Well, basically, a hate crime, also called bias-motivated crimes or bias crimes, is a crime in which a perpetrator targets a victim because of their membership or perceived membership, because there are Sikhs who have been victimized because they were perceived as Muslims, for instance, in a certain social group or race, whether it's sex, ethnicity, disability, nationality, religion, gender identity, sexual orientation. And I think the way to think about it is all crimes are serious, but hate crimes are pose particular problem in the way that in the civil world, actions may be taken against somebody which discriminate against them on one of these bases in terms of their employment or access to public accommodation. And an action that's otherwise not seen as a biased action takes on a different aspect when it's motivated by bias. And the same thing here, a crime that's motivated by bias is a very special kind of crime in terms of its implications for the individual and also for the community of which they are a part.
So, Boris, I want to ask you, what's the difference between just a standard old crime and a hate crime?
I think there's two differences that I would point to. The first difference, of course, is what the pastor described. After he had the hate crime committed against him, he was looking behind his shoulder. He felt very, very threatened because of who he is, right? And that's the impact that hate crimes have on the victims themselves. In addition, I would say that, you know, in law, we often look at two things. We look at actus rea and mens rea. So we look at the action that's done by a person and the mindset that they had when they did that action. And so when we have hate crimes, it's done with a purpose or something in mind that discriminates against an individual. So it both impacts or has an impact on the perpetrator of the action who's using that impetus or that mindset to attack this person. And then it also has an impact on the victim and the victim's community at large, who feel that it's not just a crime against one person. This is a crime against all of us, and now we all have to worry. So there's a chilling effect that happens. There's a frightening effect that happens on a community at large, rather than when it's just a sort of simple crime that doesn't have that additional mens rea or that mental sort of aspect to it.
So, Richard, what are some statistics that you found with the rate of hate crimes nowadays?
Yeah, well, I'll talk about domestic, and perhaps the professor wants to address the international scene as well. But the most recent FBI report, which was issued in November 2020 for 2019, reveals, and this has been going on for years, an alarming trend of increase in hate crimes being reported in the United States. Even though fewer law enforcement agencies, and this is really a problem, provided data to the FBI for 2019 than have done in earlier years. 2019 was the deadliest year on record. There were 51 hate crime murders. And in addition, total hate crime incidents rose to over 7,000. It was the fourth increase in the past 5 years. After declining in 2018, religion-based hate crimes increased by 7%. And 63% of the total number of religion-based hate crimes were directed at Jews and Jewish institutions. That said, the rate of increase, as opposed to absolute numbers, has been greater for anti-Muslim hate crimes, and moreover, race-based hate crimes remain the most common type of these crimes. Something like half of the hate crimes, total hate crimes in the United States, are race-based. So it's an alarming story in terms of the numbers.
Boris, what about the international scene? What have you seen?
Yeah, so I think that before I give the international sort of perspective, I think I would add that there is an observer effect. So I do think that countries around the world who weren't studying hate crimes as well as they should have been are now commissioning studies and are now having their law enforcement agencies report on hate crimes. So we have to remember that the rise in hate crimes, which I do see at the global level, can be two-factor attribution, right? One factor is that we're studying it better, they're making better records of it, where, you know, they wouldn't have made those records before, now they're doing it. But I would say that the numbers are increasing. I'll give you an example. India, a South Asian sort of leader historically in constitutional law and human rights and everything else, with a billion person population plus, is seeing a rise in hate crimes against Muslims, against untouchable or Dalit community members. And so we see this all around the world, that the numbers are increasing. And at the same time, we're seeing, and I hope to see more of, the law enforcement agencies around the world taking better tracking of this. Because oftentimes what we haven't seen in history is sort of a proper statistical analysis done and collection of data done by the police enforcement agencies themselves. So I would say that's happening at a better rate now. And so that would indicate that the numbers are going up, and that might be because we're monitoring it better. But my feeling is that based on having studied these regions and these countries, especially in Asia, Africa as well, these crimes are increasing. Hate crimes and bias-motivated crimes, as was discussed earlier, are increasing overall.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to explore why hate crimes are on the rise. Stay with us. Welcome back to our discussion today, where we're talking about the global rise in hate crimes. Richard, why is this trend occurring, especially now?
Well, you know, hate crimes are as old as humanity and certainly as old as the Republic. But I think oftentimes they take place in response to the certain, anything I say is oversimplified. Let's stipulate to that. But when people face a crisis, whether it's economic or social or a terrorist attack, they often revert to an unfortunate human tendency, which is to protect their own while finding a scapegoat to blame the problem on. And that scapegoat is often those who are clearly not us, quote unquote. And in turn, those who are victimized as individuals, as a group, seeing the world as a more dangerous place, may also find others to blame themselves. So I think most Americans, even if they're feeling this, I'm not saying most Americans feel it, but most Americans who do feel this, nevertheless don't necessarily act on these feelings of mistrust, but it only takes a relatively small number to carry out crimes that marginalize minorities. I would add to that, that we're living in an age of social media, and I think the intimate and insulated nature of social media amplifies these resentments. And when you layer on that, I think less of a sense among our public officials and leaders that they need to take care in how they speak, that this also amplifies what we're seeing going on. So there's a variety of factors, and I'm sure there are others that could be identified as well, but they add up to a really toxic environment that we're living through now, in which these kinds of crimes take place more often than they have in the past.
Richard, you mentioned social media. So, Warris, recently you testified at a hearing at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom about hate crimes in the digital world. Could you explain more about what that is?
Sure. So I think that it's sort of the rise in hate speech. And I would say, like, there's two issues here, really, to go back to the question. One is leadership matters. And second is words mean things, right? So when we have leaders that have social media presences that are expounding on certain kinds of tropes or trying to engage in dehumanizing certain groups, then that does have an impact on their followers. They have millions of followers, and they might then take those words, and that goes to my second point, leadership matters, but also words mean things. So those leaders are putting forth that narrative, and their followers are not only sort of taking in that narrative, but then also saying, okay, let's act this out. If there's threats to our community, to ourselves, let's violently remove those threats. And if, you know, a certain person is tweeting a certain thing, then that might inspire those kinds of crimes to occur in real life. And the second thing is that, of course, words mean things, right? And so when we have an information superhighway, I really agree with Richard's sort of statement here that, you know, the internet is a proliferating sort of piece of this. And the reason is because our words used to have to travel on a small country road, right? It goes really slowly, it's bumpy, we're taking a horse-drawn carriage and taking our word out to the rest of the community. Now, we have an information superhighway where you can hop on and spread and disseminate information so fast and so quickly. So the speed of communication has increased. That's also for good things, right? Like human rights and progressive ideas and discussions on that. But unfortunately, it also means that the speed of bad actors is also increased. So I would say that, you know, what we've seen is a rise in hate speech on platforms like Twitter and Facebook. And that's not just limited to that digital space. It becomes in real life, IRL, right? Through actions that are inspired by that hate speech that's happening on those platforms. So I think the proliferation of that hate speech undoubtedly causes a proliferation of violence in real life based on that.
Whereas, you're saying that words on social media can get off the internet and have, you know, real world impact. You know, I think of Charlottesville. So, Richard, you gave a speech after the Charlottesville incident where you said to strengthen the framework of coexistence America is necessary for us to work together. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, what I was thinking about is the fact that the Constitution, with all of its, whatever its flaws might be, and there certainly are historical issues that we always have to wrestle with in the creation of the Constitution, I think that the Constitution provides a framework, especially when you take into account the First Amendment, which protects freedom of religion and freedom of speech, and the 14th Amendment and its guarantee of equal protection under the law, that the Constitution for the United States is a blueprint for how to exist in a society, how to coexist in a society, which, despite our deep differences on matters that matter a lot to us, as well as the differences that clearly exist in terms of the countries people came from, their religious faiths, all those differences. Judge Leonard Hand, the esteemed judge of the middle of the 20th century, famously said, "Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. And no constitution, no law, no court can even do much to help it." So there are very important values that are entrenched in the Constitution, but those have to be strengthened by an act of will. We have to make it our mission to understand that we have to find ways to coexist with one another, and we're not doing too good a job of that, thankfully. Whether it be the weaponization of bigotry and hostility toward institutions of government, or college campuses or newspaper boards with views contrary to the perceived norm or deemed not worthy even to be expressed. On both sides, there are problems with whether or not we are inculcating Judge Hand's lesson about how we are to act upon the values and the protections of the Constitution. And that's really what I was talking about when I made those remarks.
Worris, what are your thoughts on that, on what Richard just said and what Judge Hand said?
Yeah, I think the frameworks are particularly important, and I would give sort of my comments an international edge, right? So I think that this is a unique opportunity that we have in diplomacy. We can go to countries who are facing these same kinds of outbursts of hate crimes, of hate speech, and we can go to them hat in hand and say, we have the same problems. Let's try and come up with collaborative solutions so we can abide by human rights law, we can protect people's dignity, we can protect people's right to all the things that we're talking about, free speech and everything else, and do it in a way that's collaborative and global. You know, these problems aren't just local anymore. Every problem has now become global because of the internet. So I think that Richard's point about the frameworks and working through a framework, I think working through the human rights framework, for example, and for international collaboration, unique challenges present unique times for us to step up to that challenge, right? And I think for our American diplomacy, especially under a new presidency, that's something we should definitely consider doing, sort of saying we have the same issues and let's all resolve them together. No one's better than anyone else. No one is sort of superior. We all have a developing issue. Let's come together and resolve it. So I think this is a unique opportunity for us to establish those frameworks or reestablish those frameworks of collaboration at the international level.
May I just add, I think one of the great challenges we have, and I agree with everything that was just said, is because we're talking about bigotry that's expressed in speech in a country that values free speech. I mean, you sometimes hear calls for outlawing hate speech and actions be taken not only with respect to social media, but more broadly. That's a very difficult thing for us, for we who value free speech and who understand that, you know, you may have some epithets that are per se bigoted, but there are others where, you know, one person's bigoted speech is another person's fair political comment. So I don't think the solution of this is easy to find. I think we're identifying the problem, but how we deal with that in a way that both that protects the liberties that we all value, that's a tough call. And I know a lot of people are good faith are wrestling with this and differing what the right course is to take.
So we're almost out of time, but we like to leave our viewers with a quick takeaway from today's topic. So I want to ask you, how can individuals, you know, fight against these hate crimes? What can we do personally, whether it is in person or online, to protect against them? Worris?
Yeah, I think the pastor's experience is one of the ones we should draw on. I think we as a community have to come together and tell the victims who are victims of these crimes, this isn't something you should have had to deal with. This isn't something we support as a community, and we love and support you, and we'll figure out a way to find justice and not have impunity for these people. I think that's the biggest thing. I think, you know, everyone can be subject to this kind of an action, right? So we all have to come together as a community, just like the pastor had described. His community came together almost in like a community hug around him to say, it's okay, we're with you. that's something that I think every community should be doing with each other, especially the victimized communities, whether it's the Jewish American community, whether it's the Muslim American community, whether it's the African American community. You know, we can't allow us to have silos between ourselves. We have to have empathy and compassion and love between all of these groups. And I think that's the biggest thing that I think helps both victims and then also sends a message to the perpetrators that you are not welcome here. And these actions that you're doing are not going to be accepted by us as a society at large. That's the most important thing we can do, I think.
So, Richard, what's your take on this?
Well, I certainly agree with the point of how important it is for victims to be supported, certainly in the wake of Pittsburgh and Poway. It was very important to the Jewish community there was an outpouring of support across the board from the Muslim community, from Christian communities, many others. I think also on a more granular level, we need to improve data collection and reporting of hate crimes by police officials and other state institutions. We need to recognize that these high-profile and lethal incidents are important, but also people who yell out "Hail Hitler," which I personally experienced the Sabbath afternoon following Poway, the statistics scrawled on a garage door. This is an important moment to recognize that these are not trivial incidents, how important they are to a community, that we respond to them and make clear how unacceptable they are. And finally, those in leadership positions have to be careful in how they speak and to avoid using violent imagery that may encourage violence.
Well, gentlemen, this has been an insightful conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you at home for joining us. And as always, we want to connect with you. Go to hopetv.org or talk to us on Twitter at GlobalToday7. Until next time, stay well, and I hope you'll keep the conversation going. We'll be right back.